It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we're joined with Mark Bray once again. Thank you so much for having us on the program. We're going to be talking about a new book that's out by PM Press. It's with you and one other person, correct?
Yep, me and Rob Hayworth, who's a professor and writer of education. And he has another book on PM called Anarchist Pedagogies that people should check out.
And, you know, before this happened, I went back and, read a lot about the subject. It's about somebody named Francisco Ferrer. It's about the modern school movement, which I feel like a lot of us, if you've studied the history of Spanish anarchism, if you studied the history of anarchism too, you've heard about the modern school. Obviously a lot of people know somewhat about the Spanish Civil War and Revolution that broke out in 1936, and obviously the anarchist movement that, grew leading up to that. But I feel like the modern school is kind of something that a lot of us haven't really kind of delving into a lot. And I just reading a little bit about the modern school movement and Francisco Ferrer, you know, realizing how big the modern school movement was and its impact. So just to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about, broadly, who was Francisco?
Yeah, well, but before talking to that directly, you're right that in a certain sense, people who read about anarchism in Spain in English are kind of sometimes oversaturated with the Spanish Civil War and histories of the CNT, but the events of the earlier period are much less well represented, especially in English. I got another book coming out in a couple of years called The Anarchist Inquisition. That is a history from about 1890 to 1910, which is the least studied period in the history of anarchism in Spain, at least during the kind of classical era. And probably the most important culmination of that period is Francisco Ferrer, the modern school that he created, and his eventual execution by the Spanish state in 1909 for his alleged participation, or really his alleged masterminding of this rebellion, which I'm sure we'll talk about. So who was Francisco Ferrer? He was the founder of the modern school. We'll talk more about the school later, I'm sure. But in short, the modern school was a really big deal when it was founded in Barcelona in 1901 because it was anti-religious and education at the time was Catholic education in Spain. It was co-educational. It included boys and girls. It had students from different class backgrounds. It emphasized rationality, science, and empirical investigation of the natural world, and encouraged students to sort of, become self-actualized individuals. So you can imagine in monarchist Catholic Spain that this was really controversial. But Ferrer was more than just an educator. Behind the scenes, he also funded the developing revolutionary syndicalist movement in Spain and beyond. He was an active Freemason. He was involved in what was called the Neo-Malthusian movement, which was sort of strange, but mostly focused on birth control for working class women, and a wide variety of revolutionary activities. He was allegedly involved in some conspiracies to try and kill the king. So he was a very active revolutionary figure, most known for his educational work, but he had his fingers in a variety of different projects.
Yeah, and just to kind of just lay some background about Spain at the time. I mean, so the story goes is that Bakunin traveled at one point in the late 1800s and like met with Spanish anarchists that were reading his works. And this is before the CNT was really up and running, but kind of like laid the foundations for Spanish anarchism, which continued to grow. But at the time of when the modern school kicked off in 1901, what was Spain like?
Just to clarify a few details, Bakunin actually never made it to Spain himself. When this revolution occurred in Spain in 1868, Bakunin sent one of his Italian comrades, a guy named Giuseppe Finelli, over to Spain. Finelli didn't speak a word of Spanish, but, you know, Romance languages, he could kind of communicate enough. He brought over the statutes of the First International and of Bakunin's alliance, and he met with people in Barcelona and Madrid. Most of the people he met at the time were federal Republicans, meaning that they were Republicans who wanted a republic instead of a monarchy, but they were Federalists. They didn't want a kind of reign of terror the way the Jacobin ideal was. They wanted a kind of federal decentralized republic. They were sympathetic to the workers' movement. So you can see how they'd be interested in anarchism as a kind of fulfillment of these ideas. Then the anarchist movement was essentially had to go underground in the mid to late 1870s. It popped up again in the 1880s. It became very much linked with a wide variety of projects, from unionism to radical education to theater, the arts. By the turn of the century, Spain was at a bit of a crossroads. The Spanish monarchy had lost the war with the United States in 1898. It lost its remaining overseas colonies of Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines. And so the conversation going on in the upper circles of Spanish society was how to, quote unquote, regenerate society, how to make Spain modern, because people felt like it was falling behind. And this took a variety of different forms. But one of the forms that people were talking about was education, both sort of more moderate circles and in radical circles. And so that's sort of where Francisco Ferrer's Modern School captured a lot of people's attention as a kind of proposal for how to what they would probably describe as bring Spain out of the Dark Ages, because there are all these metaphors of Spain being stuck in the Inquisition for being backwards, quote unquote. And so the Modern School grew out of this conversation around modernization and rationalization, quote unquote, of the society. And, you know, the anarchist movement went through different ebbs and flows during the period, leading it sometimes more towards unionization, sometimes more towards tactics known as propaganda by the deed. But, you know, it was the, probably at the time the strongest anarchist movement in Europe.
Well, himself, Ferrer seems to transition at some point from a Republican to an anarchist. Can you talk a little bit about this? I mean, did his obviously his politics evolved over his lifetime, but
yeah,
was there a turning point in which he fully embraced anarchism?
Yeah, as a young man living in Barcelona, he was from a small town outside of Barcelona, born in 1859. As a way of background, there was a republic created in Spain, 1873 to 1874. So when people talk about the Spanish Civil War, they talk about the Second Republic. The First Republic was in the 1870s. And when it fell apart, Republicans essentially went into two different camps. There was the one camp that wanted to work with the monarchist system, and there was the camp that wanted to actively destroy it, the revolutionary side of the Republican movement. That was the crew that Ferrer joined. So he became a courier for this important Republican leader named Manuel Ruiz Soria, who was in exile in Paris, working on the railroad. So he traveled back and forth between Spain and France, delivering messages for this Republican leader. And at the time, the Republican movement was basically geared towards trying to convince the Spanish military to side with them to overthrow the monarchy. So Ferrer was allegedly involved in these conspiracies to get soldiers to turn on the government. They all failed miserably, never getting more than maybe like 100 soldiers to join. Some say that he went into exile in France, Ferrer, that being to avoid repression from one of these conspiracies. I think it's more likely that he went because he had marital problems. If you're interested in the gossip behind the life of Francisco Ferrer, that is well represented in the book as well. So he lived in France from 1885 to 1901. He went to France as a convinced ardent Republican. But at the time, the French Third Republic was the model for what Republicans looked to. And so he went there with high hopes, which were quickly dashed. Why? Well, because in France, there was still a lot of poverty. There was still a lot of repression of the workers' movement. And principally for Ferrer, he was disappointed in the educational system. He writes that the French government simply replaced God with the state. the church with, you know, the kind of government bureaucracy. And so he started thinking about different political options. He was involved in one of the socialist parties in France for a short period of time. He attended a Congress of the Second International in 1896, where it was definitively decided to expel the anarchists. Ferrer was one of the few French socialists who actually voted to keep the anarchists in the Second International. And that was one of the reasons why he left, is that he was frustrated with that decision. And then he got increasingly interested in two important tendencies that were developing within French anarchism at the time, this being the late 1890s. One was revolutionary syndicalism, the development of the CGT, which was a kind of predecessor of the IWW or the CNT, and libertarian education. And I imagine many of your viewers or listeners know, but just to clarify, libertarian meant the same as anarchist and still does in much of the world today. So he was involved in these two currents. And when he comes to Barcelona in 1901, he founds the Modern School and he founds the newspaper La Huelga General, the General Strike, which becomes the main organ of the anarchist labor federation that existed at the time.
So in 1901, like you said, you know, in Barcelona, he sets up the Modern School. So let's just talk about it. I mean, when it starts off, I mean, how big is it? How does he get children to come to it? And generally, how is the school set up? I mean, this is in the early stages of the school.
Yeah, well, the school unfortunately only lasted for 5 years, from 1901 to 1906. So we can talk about why it fell apart later. Like all institutions, it evolved over time. And the number of students that attended increased over time, but usually didn't surpass around 100 or 115 per year. So it wasn't massive. Its influence was far greater over the coming years than the actual number of students who studied there. Initially, it was far less egalitarian than people imagine it would have been, or less egalitarian than Ferrer wrote about it when he wrote his book, The Modern School, which is translated in its entirety in English for the first time in the anarchist education book that we published. Initially, for example, there are grades, because one of Ferrer's ideas was no grades, no rewards, no punishments. That came later. Initially, there were grades. Not only were there grades, but the grades were published in the school newspaper, so everyone in the community could see what the children were doing in school, along with some comments like, this student is lazy, this student needs to work harder. If students were late, the number of times they were late was tallied and published in the newspaper. If they were late too often, they couldn't attend the school field trip. So it was more, quote-unquote, normal than you'd imagine. They had, you know, time slots for reading or for math or for French lessons from 1 to 2, 2 to 3. I think that when people imagine anarchist education, they imagine it as much more open-ended and free-form than it was back then. And part of the reason why it was like that was that Ferrer's analysis focused a great deal more on content than form. So for him, the problem with education in France, for example, was that students were being fed information that was still influenced by the church or influenced by the state. For him, the church and the state were backward institutions that needed to be destroyed. Instead, he thought students should learn based off of nature and science and rationality. So for him, you could have a traditional classroom setting with students sitting at desks with textbooks, or maybe not textbooks in the sense that we think of it, but with books. And if the teacher told them the proper information about science and rationality and so forth, that would sort of be kind of inserting the proper information into their heads. So he was much less a critic of form than of content. And in that way, he actually got into some interesting debates with other anarchists of the era in Spain who advocated what they described as a more of a kind of neutral educational model, where you don't try to sort of, you know, tell the students what's wrong with the church or the state or capitalism. You just kind of present information and let them figure it out on their own. So these are interesting debates, and the book publishes these different perspectives on these different methods. But, you know, in general, despite these sort of more traditional forms, for its time, the Modern School was really vastly different from other schools in Spain. In terms of the range of subjects taught, the focus on science, the focus on the natural world. They would do field trips to, which was important for urban youth, field trips outside the city. They took a field trip to a factory, for example, so the students could learn about the quote-unquote wonders of modern industry, but then discuss how the revenues of industry weren't properly distributed. What else? So the school became more egalitarian over time. They did get rid of grades. They did get rid of rewards and punishments. But still, the structure was kind of relatively traditional by our standards.
Right.
And some of its greatest innovations have now become mainstream.
So this is the original schools in Barcelona in 1901. You said there was about 100 kids per year that went there. Who were these kids? Were they, you know, working class kids? Were they like children of middle class families that wanted them to have like an exciting alternative? Or, I mean, was it a mix?
So you have to remember that poor families couldn't afford to have their children out of the factory or the fields. So, you know, working class families had kids that worked at this time. So the ability to go to school was a marker of some measure of class privilege right off the bat. Beyond that, Ferrer was very ardent about education that was cross-class. In the book, he describes his reasoning on that, but he argues that in a certain sense, educational spaces should be kind of laboratories for the future society where people live in harmony together. So he thought it should be cross-class. And in that way, although there was a fee to attend, it was sort of sliding scale. That having been said, it seems like most of the students came from middle class backgrounds and they had parents who were, you know, on the more progressive end of things. Now, just as a side note, later on when the CNT, anarcho-syndicalist labor union, creates Ferrerian schools in the 1930s, they abandon Ferrer's cross-class focus and they make the schools avowedly proletarian institutions. So, you know, different perspectives on that.
Can we talk a little bit about the transitioning between more of a traditional model, you said, and then to the point where, like you were describing, no grades, no rewards, no punishments? I mean, and also, too, I think that question necessitates us talking about is how is the school actually organized, like the people that were running the physical institution?
There isn't a ton of information on that nitty-gritty, because I was fascinated about that as well. And really, Ferrer and the modern school are a mix of contradictions. So on the one hand, Ferrer is pretty close to being an anarchist. Yet he seems to have made the important decisions pretty much exclusively by himself, which would be anathema to any kind of anarchist educational project. The teachers that taught there, I published correspondence where he talks to some of his friends and he says, look, we want teachers who share our values. It'd be great if they're anarchists, but at least they should be anti-clerical. So it gives you some sort of sense of the kind of political litmus test that's being run for the faculty. Some of the teachers were local radicals. We don't have a full list, unfortunately. There were some teachers who focused on different subjects. So one of Ferrer's partners was a French teacher at the school. So, you know, we have some information, but not a ton as to the kind of nitty-gritty. Another thing to mention that's interesting is that on Sundays, they had these Sunday conferences for parents and children where they would come to the school and they would have usually someone from the University of Barcelona do a kind of presentation about science, a lot of times about hygiene, because one of the main focuses of the school was hygiene, this new kind of science of preventing diseases, and especially among working class populations, how to, you know, get new scientific methods. So a lot of this, of course, carries problematic assumptions about the relationship between science and progress, which were very widespread across all layers of European society at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think by today's standards, we would be very critical of some of these, like you said, the idea that science is going to, you know, progresses towards some, you know, wonderful phase of society. But also, I mean, coming from their position where they're so bogged down by the church, I mean, they were seeing science as kind of a liberatory, you know, way of looking at the world, I guess.
Right. It's important to understand any historical incident or figure in its context. Almost all anarchists of the era in Europe were completely wrapped up in the dominant notion of science, progress, rationality, the forward march of time. There were a few who took positions that were somewhat reminiscent of what we might now think of a kind of postmodern critique of those things, but they were rare, and even their positions usually didn't entirely escape the kind of dominant paradigm. But you're right that you also have to understand Ferrer and the school and the positions that it took in context with the dominant Catholic paradigm, where students were basically just taught the catechism at school. And so, you know, most historical incidents and events and figures have this kind of duality to them.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the role of the Catholic Church in Spanish life in a second. But, you know, after 1901, the school is set up, and then the school kind of began to grow, and there were more and more schools that were, you know, added. And I'm just curious, you know, how many more were there? Were they organized around the same lines, or were they different? Were they also broadly anarchist? And, you know, how were they networked together, if at all, or federated?
So there were a couple of official branches of the Mormon school in nearby towns, but more than that, there were a lot of secular schools that used modern school books, and so therefore the influence was a little bit more diffuse. It's not like Ferrer oversaw what they did. There are some books that I cite in Spanish about the modern school in Valencia and a few other of the modern schools, which seem to have been fairly similar. After Ferrer is executed, of course, then there are schools that are opened around the world, which, you know, their methods and their values range very widely. But the ones that were created during his lifetime in Spain seem to have been more or less similar, using similar kinds of books, and not just influenced by him and his school, but also older traditions of secular education that grew out of the Republican movement.
You know, we keep talking about like secular education. I mean, I think this is really important to talk about understanding Spain, and also because it's, you know, very different than life in the United States. You know, historically, the anarchist movement was very opposed to the role and the authority of the Catholic Church in daily life. You know, we've all heard stories about the Spanish Revolution, people shooting at churches, you know, destroying, you know, religious institutions when the revolution broke out. I mean, why were people so opposed to the Catholic Church, and, like, you know, what role did it play at that period, and why did that make people so angry?
If you go back even to the French Revolution, before there was a kind of official anarchist movement, the Catholic Church was seen as the ideological foundation for the old absolutist world. And so the Republican revolutionary traditions that developed in Europe in the 19th century, that developed in Latin America, that developed elsewhere, that places where the Catholic Church had a strong hold, saw the Catholic Church as the glue that held together the world of oppression that they were fighting against. This is especially true in Spain in the 19th and into the 20th centuries, where, you know, if you want to look at the monarchy, if you want to look at the development of capitalism, if you want to look at the state, the kind of justification for all of these forms of oppression from the anarchist perspective boiled down to the church. You look at the flip side, and we were discussing this before, how so many anarchists saw anarchism as kind of the embodiment of rationality and science and truth and progress. Then, of course, the inverse of that would be what they saw as superstition, backward medieval Catholic notions, and so forth and so on. So it's a kind of natural conflict. Now, there were some Christian anarchists, I think, in Spain. I mean, you have Tolstoy. You know, there were some early efforts to try and talk about, you know, Jesus as a worker and so forth, but they were very much in the minority. And even today in countries like Spain or France, the notion of a kind of left religiosity is really anathema. And then, of course, that can open up problematic examples of kind of left Islamophobia, for example. So there's a whole nother conversation, but it dates far back, and the Catholic Church was seen as the embodiment of reaction. That was the case in the Spanish Civil War, where almost the entirety of the Catholic Church supported Franco and the fascists. The only exception, I believe, was the Catholic Church in the Basque Country, because their nationalist perspective on Basque autonomy put them against the fascists. But, you know, that's the history, and that's where the anarchists found themselves. And it wasn't really unique to Spain. 19th century, early 20th century anarchism, really the main focus was always kind of capital, state, and church. It's only, I think, in recent decades that anarchists have sort of, in the United States and some other countries, have reduced the religious question compared to what it was historically.
And then we're going to talk about what happened in 1906 with Frère. He got in some trouble in a second. But I just kind of want to go back to the school itself. And, you know, at this point, you know, his influence has grown. There's different experiments. You know, the modern school is still going. But, you know, towards, you know, kind of 5 years into the project, how were students learning at the school? And, you know, just like basically like as it had evolved over a couple years, like, and it became more anti-authoritarian, more libertarian. Can you just describe kind of like how that looked?
Yeah, so the information we have on it, again, is somewhat limited. A lot of it comes from the Modern School newspaper. And so you'd think that a school newspaper for an elementary school would focus on, like, you know, projects that the students are doing. But a lot of it was, like, high-level theoretical essays about education, you know, reprinting essays from Thoreau and so forth. I mean, rather Rousseau. So, but we do get glimpses. For example, Ferrer published a collection of writings that the students wrote about different subjects. And he clearly took great pride in ways that when students wrote about seemingly apolitical topics, they would politicize them. So, for example, there's an excerpt from a student writing about parasites, which ends up talking about bosses as parasites. An essay talking about honesty, where the student says it's always good to be honest, but if someone comes to your house running away from the police, you should be dishonest and tell the police they never came to your house. You know, stuff like that. And what's interesting, yeah, it's the quotes are great, so I encourage people to check them out in the book.
I'm just imagining the teachers, you know, spicing their
their
discussions with the kids with certain stories.
Yeah, right. And the kids loving it. But what's interesting is that I think in the United States, regardless of our politics, we have this notion, rightly or wrongly, that students should always disagree on everything. And Ferrer took great pride when his students all came to what he perceived to be the right answer about something. So sometimes he even published kind of summaries of what all the students said in his own words. Like, basically, they were talking about this and they agreed, which, you know, it's not exactly expressing the students' perspectives on something. It's hard to really know exactly what happened in the classroom, exactly what the students thought. And also there's very little information on what most of these students ended up doing years later. So what we have is what Ferrer wrote about the book. We have the modern school newspapers. We have little extracts from different observers. But it's hard to say definitively, which is why, in some ways, the idea of the modern school has had more of an impact than the school itself, because there's some uncertainty as to what actually went on.
So 5 years after the school has been open in Barcelona, the Spanish state really started to get freaked out about it, and it tried to tie Ferrer to the assassination attempt on the king. Can we just talk a little bit about what happened in this incident?
Right. Mateo Moral was an anarchist. He was the son of an industrialist in Catalonia who became the administrator of the publishing house of the modern school, sort of a kind of AK press of its era, publishing all sorts of radical educational and other kinds of other materials. Mateo Moral was a fascinating figure who was involved in a wide variety of revolutionary struggles, but he's most known for attempting to assassinate the king, Alfonso XIII, in 1906. Essentially what happened is he goes to Madrid. The king is getting married to an English princess, and after their wedding, they're riding their carriage back to the royal palace when Mateo Moral throws a bouquet of flowers out of the top floor of a building that on a main street, and the bouquet of flowers is covering a bomb. The bomb explodes right next to the royal carriage. The royal couple are unharmed, but bystanders, I think something in the neighborhood of 25 bystanders are killed and about 100 injured. They included just random people in addition to soldiers and government officials. So Morrell manages to escape. He flees to a nearby town. A couple days later, the police find him. He shoots and kills one of the police officers and then shoots and kills himself, committing suicide. So Morrell can't say anything about what happened, but Ferrer is among those who's arrested and charged. Initially, he was facing a death penalty, but that was reduced to a charge of 16 years for being a mastermind behind the plot. He was acquitted in 1906, so he was not sent to prison. And there is no definitive evidence as to his participation in the plot, but there's a lot of small pieces that, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a number of other historians, strongly suggest that actually he was behind the conspiracy, along with a few other people. And what's interesting is that kind of points to the kind of duality of Francisco Ferrer, that publicly he was this mild-mannered, nonviolent educational theorist. Behind the scenes, if you read his writings about the general strike, revolutionary violence, he was yearning for a social upheaval and sympathetic to the notion that maybe blowing up the king could create the kind of space for that to happen.
Thank you.
just real quick, I think this is a fascinating kind of aside, but I mean, you know, in this period of time, you know, obviously there was the idea of propaganda by the deed. I mean, this is playing out in the United States and other countries. I mean, and there were numerous examples of anarchists killing and assassinating, you know, kings and presidents and everything like that. I'm just curious, like, as you would see it as a historian, like, how did those ideas play out? Because it seems like eventually, like in instances like this, I mean, like it you know, it didn't achieve its goal and then end up killing some random people.
Right.
You know, there were numerous instances in the United States, I think, like, you know, the bombing of Wall Street, you know, that had, you know, pretty dramatic repercussions on the anarchist movement itself. You know, was there a period in which people kind of shifted and just said, like, overall, like, hey, this stuff doesn't work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it ebbed and flowed. There were periods in different countries during this period when the popularity of that came and went. I think, though, that there are a few important things to clarify. One is that, at least in my research on anarchist movements in Spain and France and nearby countries, most anarchists were not dead set for or against it, but would evaluate different acts of propaganda by the deed on a case-by-case basis, based on whether they thought the target was a useful target, whether they were innocent casualties in the process. So one of the more popular instances of propaganda by the deed during the era was when an Italian anarchist assassinated the prime minister of Spain in 1897 because he was held responsible for the torture of anarchists in Spain and for essentially the genocide in Cuba during the resistance to the Spanish monarchy there. So that was a pretty popular one, and actually probably in terms of cause and effect, one of the most successful, because when that prime minister was killed, the one who replaced him essentially undid all of his policies. So that resulted in immediate effects. But for the most part, though, obviously, as a method of revolutionary struggle, it brought more repression than anything else. I do think it's important to clarify between propaganda by the deed as kind of an act of an isolated individual versus, for example, once you get the kind of C&T conflicts with the pistoleros in the 20s and 30s, having a kind of armed wing of an organized union movement, I think is a different animal. And the kind of rationale within revolutionary struggle of having kind of armed militia-like formations is a different category. The individual propaganda by the deed, for the most part, brought repression and was usually counterproductive. But on the other hand, I think there were instances when some of these state officials thought twice about repressive measures because of the fear of getting assassinated for them. On the other hand, right, some of the assassinations justified repression. So,
or you bosses, know, too. I mean,
right. That's the other thing, is that in just taking Barcelona, for example, which came to be known as the city of the bombs in the first decade of the 20th century, wow, in the 1880s, it was outside of Russia, especially during like the 1905 Russian Revolution, Spain was the European country by far with the most acts of propaganda by the deed during this period. So Barcelona became known as the city of the bombs. But prior to that name, in the 1880s, there were dozens of bombings on the homes or factories of employers involved in labor disputes. So there's this sort of unspoken history of propaganda by the deed, not necessarily thought of as such, involved in specific labor disputes to try and leverage bosses, which is also kind of a different consideration from the kind of isolated individual who wants to carry out a symbolic act. It's an interesting history.
You saw that in the United States, yeah, too. I mean, during the, I think it was the LA Times strike, there was a famous bombing of one of the buildings.
Mm, yeah, correct, yeah.
Yeah, but I just think it's interesting to point that out. And like you said, I mean, obviously, you know, like, none of these tactics, I mean, kind of went away. I mean, obviously, you had the formation of the FAI. I mean, Derruti was famously, on top of being a, you know, a famous, you know, writer and organizer and militia member, but also, you know, a bank robber and, you know, somebody that fought against, like you said, the pistoleros, people that would try to kill strikers and all that, and had to flee the country at certain times.
Right. So I think that it's important to see tactics in the context of what kind of struggles they're related to. And that those are two very kind of stark differences there. It's also interesting that in my experience in Spain today, the legacy of propaganda by the deed, even if it's not something that's actively carried out by most of the libertarian movement over there, I think is held with a little bit more respect than it is in the United States, which I find interesting.
So what happened to Ferrer? So, I mean, he gets caught up in this.
School gets shut down in 1906. He's charged but acquitted. He goes into exile for a while. He travels to different cities in Western Europe where people organized protests on his behalf, because his imprisonment did stir up a kind of international protest campaign that mostly developed in France and Italy and England, Portugal, Belgium, Netherlands. He looks around for books that he can translate into Spanish for his future educational projects. He organizes the International League for Rational Education with groups in different European cities and a few Latin American cities. And essentially what ends up wrapping up his biography is that he's in England in 1909 when his sister-in-law and some of his nieces and nephews get really sick back in Catalonia. So he comes back despite the fact that some of his friends are telling him, hey, don't ever go back to Spain, they'll kill you. He goes back and he ends up being in Catalonia when the tragic Weak Rebellion of 1909 occurs.
And how did he get caught up in what ultimately led to his execution?
Well, the short story is he gets arrested and charged with being the mastermind of this uprising. So first, a word on the uprising.
Sure.
After Spain loses Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, it invests efforts in consolidating a hold on part of Morocco. So Morocco at this time is divided between Spain and France, and in 1909 there's essentially an anti-colonial uprising in the Spanish section. So the government sends in the military. Spain had a conscript military, meaning that basically, I mean, just like today the poor people fight, but there was no kind of superficial narrative of volunteer participation. People were forced to fight. Rich people could pay their way out. So it was very explicitly a class formation. So when the soldiers were ready to disembark in Barcelona, this group of rich women shows up to give them little medals to essentially thank them for their service. The soldiers throw the medals in the water and start shouting, "Let the rich go," and they basically organize a military strike. This is supported by Solidaridad Obrera, or Workers' Solidarity, which was the Libertarian Labor Federation that preceded the CNT. So there's a general strike called. And this ends up taking a largely anti-clerical form of rebellion, where people go around burning churches, looting churches, and actually digging up the bodies of the clergy and dancing with them in the street, which is a rather strange turn of events. Of course.
Very black metal.
Oh, you should see some of the photos. I think there's some in the book.
Oh, there are.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is that these photos include people posing alongside these corpses, clearly not ashamed or concerned about being identified as having done this. This grew, of course, out of the kind of anti-clerical history that we discussed, and also because essentially one of the main industrialists or rich people that was involved with mine operations in Morocco was also strongly connected to the Jesuits. So they basically blamed the war on the church. So it lasts for a week. It's eventually put down by the military, as often happens. Ferrer's blamed as being the mastermind. Now, here, historians are unanimous that there is no evidence whatsoever that there was a mastermind at all, and if there was, that it was Francisco Ferrer. But the irony is that he really wanted to be the mastermind, because when the rebellion started, he went around going to all the different factions. He talked to the Republican leaders. He tried to talk to the Unionists, basically giving them his advice on what to do, and no one wanted to talk to him, in part because the Republicans thought he was a little too much of an anarchist. The anarchists thought he was a little too much of a Republican. the unionists thought he was a little too bourgeois, and he had the kind of reputation connected with his association with the 1906 assassination attempt, so people didn't want to be seen next to someone who was already kind of a target for the state. So his efforts to influence the course of events totally failed. Nevertheless, the government took it as an opportunity to avenge his being acquitted from 1906, and he was brought before a very kind of perfunctory military tribunal, and he was executed in the moat outside of Montjuïc Castle overlooking Barcelona on October 13th, 1909.
Wow. This is by firing squad?
Yep.
Huh. Interesting. So after his death, what happens? I mean, there's obviously a lot of people that were watching his case, only a couple years earlier, but people formed schools. I mean, there were demonstrations all over. I mean, I remember reading that, Malatesta and Kropotkin and I think H.G. Wells and a bunch of other people spoke in Britain. There were just demonstrations all over in support of him, but also there was a lot of people that were galvanized, much like when Sacco and Vanzetti were executed or the Haymarket murders.
Exactly, exactly. And I think it's worth putting the protest movement around Ferrer's execution and also the smaller one that occurred when he was on trial in 1906 within that history of movements against, the execution of the Haymarket martyrs that eventually culminated in Sacco and Vanzetti and other kind of similar protest movements of the era. Yeah. So basically the two main focuses of the reaction were the protest movement and the modern school movement. So for the protest movement, there were general strikes and insurrections and rioting in a number of countries, most notably in Catholic countries like France and Italy and Belgium. So a lot of the response to his execution boiled down to religion. Anti-clericalism in Catholic countries and then in Protestant countries, the kind of Protestant anti-Catholic sentiment gained a lot of popular support among Protestants. So yeah, there were protest movements. There were, obituaries eulogies written by all sorts of prominent individuals, because the dramatic way in which he was executed elevated his ideas and the legacy of his school into the kind of international stratosphere in a way that never would have happened if he weren't killed. And then that triggered the modern school movement, where like-minded people opened up schools influenced by his ideas in China and Japan, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Cuba, Chile, Argentina, the United States, all over the world. Now, what's interesting about those schools is that they varied widely because people didn't really have a lot to go on. Ferrer, in 1908, wrote a book called The Modern School, which was translated into a number of different languages. In English, it was translated, and I think it was 1913, under the title The Origins and Ideals of the Modern School. That was only about two-thirds of the text. We translated the entirety of it for this PM book. But in that book, Ferrer talks about kind of the best interpretations of what the school was. And its focus is a lot on kind of the ideas of education, what the educational content should include, and histories of how the school came to be. A lot of the nitty-gritty details are left out because he wasn't really interested in them. So the way that these schools played out were very different. One of the most important and lasting Ferrer schools was in New Jersey, actually. Originally, it was organized in New York, by Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, and some of their comrades. But in 1914, Alexander Berkman was involved in a plot to blow up one of the Rockefellers, and some of his comrades were putting together a bomb. I think it was the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and they accidentally blew themselves up. So to avoid that repression, they moved the Ferrer Association and the school to New Jersey near Rutgers, and that Stelton Colony, as they called it, lasted until the mid-50s. But at that school, students could literally do whatever they want whenever they wanted. They didn't have to start to learn reading until they felt like it. And so in that way, it was very different from Ferrer's Barcelona school.
you know, I just think, again, it's really interesting just Ferrer as a person, you know, like you were saying, he, you know, founded a paper called The General Strike. I mean, he's involved in the revolutionary anarcho-syndicalist movement. I mean, he's obviously tied, at least, you know, in history to, you know, these very, you know, grandiose militant actions. And I think a lot of people would find it strange that you have this guy whose life seemingly revolves around children and school and education and but also, like, you know, is this revolutionary anarchist. And I'm just curious, how do you think he himself would respond to people perhaps seeing a contradiction in that?
Right. Well, during his life, he never had to respond to that because only his closest collaborators knew that he was sort of leading a political double life, so to speak. But in his mind, there was absolutely no contradiction because his belief was that if you are sincere about truth and reason, you will conclude that the state is oppressive, that capitalism is unjust, that the church is quote unquote backwards. And if you come to these conclusions, in his perspective, anarchism was the fulfillment of the kind of negation of these oppressive forces that would open the way for the free flourishing of humanity. The question, of course, is how to get there. In Ferrer's mind, in the minds of most anarchists of the era, that would necessarily require a conflict with the forces of capital, the forces of the state. And so, for example, as you mentioned, he was very interested in the general strike as a mode of struggle. It was a mode of struggle that had been talked about during the First International, but its prominence within European revolutionary circles reemerged in the 1890s into the 1900s. But at this time in Spain, most anarchists were interested in it primarily as a vehicle to spark an insurrection. So you call a general strike, the state calls out the police, and then you have the insurrection that could hopefully, you know, lead to building a new world. It wasn't sort of the kind of bread and butter syndicalist notion of simply the workers put their hands in their pockets. In 1902, Barcelona witnesses one of the largest general strikes Europe had ever seen up until that point, with close to 100,000 workers walking off the job. And it ends up in sort of a low-level civil war situation. And Ferrer argues that it failed because the workers' movement was insufficiently prepared to segue from a general strike into a revolution. And so in one of his articles, he writes that you'd be better off not organizing a general strike if it had to be peaceful. So he's very convinced of the need for revolutionary violence, both by the workers' movement and also, I would argue, he was still sympathetic to that kind of old school Republican notion that if you could just take out the king, it would open up space for creating a new world. So I think that he had a vision of revolutionary transformation that included short-term, medium-term, and long-term change. The long-term, of course, being the educational process where you teach children, you kind of, as he saw it, you root out error from the foundation. Medium-term change in terms of building a workers' movement that could create a kind of counterpower to state and capital. And short-term in terms of working with radical Republicans and other figures to concoct plots behind the scenes to take out the king. There are shreds of evidence to even suggest that he was involved with an earlier plot to kill the king of Spain when he was visiting France in 1905. He wrote a letter to one of his friends saying the day will be May 30th, the day the king was scheduled to go there. It's a little bit speculative, but he saw it as no contradiction, as essentially if you want to build a just world, that would involve destroying the forces of injustice.
Well, I want to turn now to, you know, after his death, you know, the anarchist movement in Spain obviously continued to grow. There was a decision by, you know, a large part of the anarchist movement to really get involved in the CNT and to make it, you know, break with electoralism, much like with the IWW in the U.S., at least in terms of, you know, not wanting to engage with the state in terms of voting and all that stuff. Then obviously the FAI was created. And as you were saying, the kind of the modern school kind of had a rebirth with the CNT, at least kind of like a model based off of it. I'm just curious, how big of a role did Ferrer and the modern school movement play in this development of Spanish anarchism leading into of course, the 1930s.
It was central. Basically, Ferrerian educational theory was the foundation of the CNT educational initiatives, especially in the 1930s. And it's interesting that you mentioned the FAI, the Iberian Anarchist Federation, because a lot of the most ardent educational figures within the anarchist movement in the 1930s were FAIistas, as they called themselves. I talk about a few of them in the section about that in the book. One of them was actually went into exile in France after the war, after the Spanish Civil War, was involved in the resistance against the Nazis and ended up being killed in a German concentration camp. Really some fascinating and tragic histories. But yeah, they made a few adjustments, though, to Ferrer's educational model. One we talked about before, they made education a avowedly proletarian endeavor. So the notion of cross-class education was something that threw out the window. They also took seriously, or more seriously, the notion of integral education. So the idea of integral education was that you transcend the dichotomy that exists in capitalist society between people who work with their hands and people who work with their minds. And the notion of integral education was central to how all sorts of different socialists and radicals thought about education in the 19th century. Ferrer embraced this idea, but in practice, his modern school leaned heavily towards the kind of mental side of things. And the CNT schools did much more to have that more balanced. But otherwise, it was the foundation of what they did. And just as an aside, in the introduction of the book, I talk about an experience I had in 2011. I met a bunch of Spanish anarchist exiles from the war who had moved to Paris. And we talked about all sorts of aspects of the Spanish Revolutionary Movement. And when I was getting ready to leave, they gave me this little postcard with an image of Ferrer and on the other side his biography. And they, from their perspective, Ferrer and his ideas about education were the most important legacy of that tradition. And they really encouraged me to learn about it. So that's a kind of an anecdote that always sticks with me from that.
What was the size and the scope of kind of the CNT modern schools? I mean, because I know that they were, you know, the CNT was setting up, like, I don't know, we would see them as like community centers today, but basically like infrastructure for workers to engage with, and also like union halls and stuff like that. Was the modern schools run out of that? And I'm just curious, like, if we could put a number on how many kids were going at a certain time.
There may be estimates available in some of the Spanish language books I cite. I don't remember the numbers exactly, but it was pretty broad. You're right that there were all sorts of different initiatives set up. Also, Ferrer had initially intended to organize a night school for workers that didn't end up happening, but the CNT did organize adult educational initiatives. Basically throughout the areas that the anarchists had a strong presence, they put Ferrerian ideas of education into practice in the local schools. You know, certainly in places where there were mixed, you know, CNT, UGT presence, then I'm sure there was a bit more of a conversation as far as how to do joint endeavors, but it was pretty widespread. I don't know the exact numbers, though.
Huh, interesting. In terms of the U.S., were there experiments with setting up modern school or modern school-influenced type schools?
Yeah, especially prior to World War II. In Detroit, in California, well, today, apparently, I was out there in the Bay Area recently, and Ramsey from PM Press said that in Oakland, there's a free school that essentially grew out of the Ferrer lineage. Are you familiar with that one?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I forgot the exact name. But yeah, apparently in California, I think there were some somewhere else. Frankly, I haven't read my own section on that in a little while, so if people are curious about that, they can check out the book.
Okay. But definitely in the United States, there were schools that were set up.
Oh, yeah, and tons in Latin America, especially Cuba, Chile, Argentina, Mexico. One other thing to mention is that actually during the Russian Revolution, when Nestor Makhno and his anarchist revolutionaries set up their anarchist space in Ukraine, they used Ferrarian educational methods for their school as well.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's love to hear about that too. I'm just curious, you know, just in closing, across the world, like, what is the legacy of Ferrer's ideas? And, like, is he seen as kind of an integral part of those that would speak of, like, kind of a non-compulsory or, you know, anti-authoritarian way of education? Because there is, like, a growing body of thought of people that are interested in that. And I'm curious, is he seen as part of that legacy today? And how much of an influence does he have?
You know, his influence is not very large. He was a big deal prior to World War II. I feel like, as with a lot of aspects of left politics, there was a big break with World War II. And so a lot of the initiatives and ideas that came out of the 60s and 70s around alternative, radical, libertarian pedagogy really grew out of different traditions. You know, Paulo Freire, of course. A lot of people get Ferrere and Freire confused. Which is understandable. You know, Montessori traditions. I'm not super well versed in that stuff. My co-editor Rob Hayworth is the education theorist, but really new traditions emerged, and part of it is simply kind of a historical amnesia, but part of it is also because actually a lot of the foundation of what Ferrer and the modern school were about were still really stuck in a kind of 19th century positivist colonial view on truth, education, and science, which subsequently future generations rightly looked negatively upon. So, you know, some people get confused. I'm not saying that we should do exactly as Ferrer did. I don't think we should ever do exactly as earlier historical actors did, but learning about the kind of pros and cons, strengths and weaknesses, challenges and limitations of earlier initiatives, I think, is revelatory to think about how we can do it better today.
Do you see these types of ideas like as being something that we could begin to play with in the United States? I mean, I think, you know, just off the bat, even just beyond education, I mean, one of the things that so many working class and poor families need is just childcare.
Right.
And just a place to, like, take your kids that, you know, isn't going to do something bad to them or, you know, and also going to offer them resources.
Yeah. Of course, we need all sorts of local initiatives to make it sustainable for working class families to exist, educational and otherwise. You know, the conversation's a little different. Like, for example, I was in Spain a few years ago where a group of anarchists from the CNT were debating the movement in support for public health care there. They had public health care with austerity measures. It's under attack. The question of defending public health care, with one anarchist saying, of course we defend it, the other saying, well, we're against state initiatives, right? That's a debate that's not happening in the U.S. We don't have public health care. I would imagine most anarchists would be sympathetic, despite the limitations of the state, to having public health care. Similarly with schools, back in Ferrer's day, the notion of state education among the anarchist movement was entirely anathema. Today, the conversation's more around resisting privatization and the influence of corporations. So it's a different political landscape. But I still think that no matter the landscape, anarchists need to keep their, you know, philosophical and theoretical center of gravity in what can we do outside and against the state. And so that may or may not look like alternative schools. The feasibility of sort of creating a non-state school system to challenge the state school system, I'm not sure if that's necessarily feasible or the most productive use of time, but if people do that, more power to them. Either way, though, as you referenced, I think creating initiatives from the bottom up where they're needed has to be the kind of way to move forward.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.